too bad. How are you?
Yeah, yeah, good. Yeah, cheers for doing this.
No problem. Yeah, it's despite my minimal contribution on the field of play. in and around Boothry Park.
Yeah, spot on there, yeah. So where are you in the minute? Are you in York?
Yes, yeah, I'm just living in York now, working at York St John University in the School of Health. So, yeah, all's good. And then doing a bit of coaching for the FA, the England Cerebral Palsy football team and the England Deaf men's team. So keeping my football interest through that and still following Sheffield Wednesday, who have a habit of losing playoff finals to certain teams.
Yeah, yeah. I think I saw a picture of you at St George's Park. Do you work down there a bit?
Yeah, that's where most of the para camps are held. So we have kind of weekend camps down at St George's Park leading up to various tournaments. So we've got the Cerebral Palsy World Cup in Salou in Spain. That's end of April. And then the Deaf have got a World Cup in Korea next year. So between those two squads and the various tournaments, it keeps me quite busy.
Ah, nice one. Do you have to get like coaching badges and stuff to do that?
Yeah, well, when I finished playing, I kind of got into coaching quite quickly, got my UEFA B within a couple of seasons of leaving City. And then I think I got my A licence when I was about 27, so I was relatively young. And then through that, I kind of worked at the Centre of Excellence, as it was then, at City. And then through a friend of mine, Brian Johnson, who got in touch when I moved to York, saying that the Northeastern Yorkshire Cerebral Palsy team trained here would I be interested. So I went down and got involved that way. And then I think because I'd got a background in professional football and I got my A licence, I kind of came on the radar for the FA when the sort of more senior post came up with the sort of the national team. So, yeah, got Bri Johnson to thank for that.
Excellent. Yeah, legend Bri, yeah. Quality. So in terms of getting those badges, like how tough is it?
It's changed quite a lot as football lad. I was when I knew I was going to be doing this interview, I kind of just having a little look back at my very brief Hull City career, and it's like 25 years ago almost to the day that I made my debut. So I don't know where that time's gone, but the sort of coaching qualifications, they are, you know, they don't just give them away, particularly when you start getting to A license level. And there's quite a lot of theory looking at different aspects of the game, as well as just getting out on the pitch and, you know, how you can deliver sessions, how you can get messages across to players, analysis and all that kind of stuff. But when I did it, it was quite interesting because I did it on, you've got like Ray Wilkins was on the same course as me, Barry Horn, but certain even ex-professionals who, you know, they're a master of the trade in terms of playing, when it comes to actually putting on a session in front of other people, they can get quite nervous. And the old format used to be a kind of over a couple of years, you'd do a lot of your theory work away and you create a sort of coaching portfolio. And then you'd turn up for an assessment where you have to put on a session on a particular topic. And honestly, you've got players who've played international football, you know, make it look like it's a walk in the park. But then to do these sessions, they're kind of flapping around and asking all sorts of questions and getting nervous. And because it is that kind of almost do or die, you've got to pass the assessment. But nowadays, I know it's changed quite a lot where it's more of a, they come into your club and watch you over a period of time. And it's more a kind of two-way street in terms of, you know, how you try to implement your coaching ethos and all that sort of stuff. But I know when I did it, it definitely was a, quite a nerve-wracking experience.
But yeah, it must be a proud moment when you're leading those teams out then as manager.
Oh, yeah, it's fantastic. Because obviously, when you kind of come out of the pro game and, you know, still playing semi-professional here and there, you kind of idea of representing your country, you know, goes out the window. And not that I was kind of one of the sort of person who was thinking, I'm definitely going to play for England, I'm definitely going to do this. But when you're a kid, you want to be at a World Cup, you want to be at a Euros, you want to wear the England kit. And it was interesting when I got involved that it is done so professionally. That, you know, it's brilliant how the para sport has developed over over a number of years, and it's just going from strength to strength, really, in the kind of infrastructure, like with the FA getting behind it. You know, when you turn up, it is, everything's, you know, so professional. We've got psychologists, we've got doctor, physio, analyst, strength and conditioning. And when it comes to match days and its official fixtures, it is the whole national anthems, flags out on the pitch. And yeah, it is a proud moment when you stood there and you kind of all linking arms and the national anthem comes on and you look at that flag thinking, yeah, didn't think I'd be doing this in a sort of football world. And yeah, now here I am.
Were you able to like build a bit of a coaching team of people you knew, kind of thing?
The position I'm the assistant coach.
Right.
But I got the role with the Death squad. Obviously, like I said, I've got the qualifications and the experience, but the head coach, Andy Smith, I'd worked with him within cerebral palsy. And so he kind of got me involved with that. But it's interesting how many people you see now, obviously the age I'm at, when you go into various sort of coaching conferences or you see a name of the pro game, people who you played with or played against are now kind of popping up in all sorts of coaching positions within clubs. And it's a nice route to go down and a good way of sort of staying involved in the game. You can't be playing, but second to that, then coaching is where it's at.
Yeah, yeah. And how impressive is St George's Park for someone who hasn't been there?
Oh, it's fantastic. I mean, you've got to be careful that you can get a bit blasé with sort of certain facilities. You know, if you do something so many times, but every time I go down there, I'm fully appreciative of just how amazing it is. And even in this day and age, I know a lot of the top clubs have got world class training facilities because that's the way the game's going. But there's still quite a lot of clubs who don't have that sort of financial backing, who have a facility, but it's not got the, you know, even turning what was some rolling countryside into kind of international standard pitches, the cost involved in that, you know, every time you're down there, even though I'm coaching, I'll always, once we've got the session set up before the players come out, I just take a picture of the sort of session set up just as a kind of reminder of this is, you know, the stripes going across the grass and everything. And it, you know, if you love football and, you know, if you don't love that, then, you know, it's not the game for you.
Let's take it back a bit then. Obviously, a Hull lad. What are your first memories of Boothroyd Park?
Well, interestingly, as you said, being a Hull lad, our kind of first memories really of Boothroyd Park were when I was playing for the schools. I know a few of the other players. I've listened to the podcast, really enjoyed them, particularly kind of the lads that I know, Adam Lowfort, Rich Peacock, Hobbo. But then also some of the other players who've been were in and around the club, you know, before almost the dark days when I was there, and had sort of, you know, really successful careers with the club. But for me, it was around like the very early 90s, getting my full schoolboys pass for the South Stand. So you'd play full schools in the morning, and then a group of us would go and watch the game in the afternoon. And so kind of Andy Payton, Peter Swan, Gareth Roberts, that kind of era. So that was my sort of first memories, really.
Yeah, yeah. And then what about in terms of actually playing? Because you went to Sheffield Wednesday before City, is that right?
Yeah, well, so growing up in Hull, I played at Boothroyd Park a few times for the schools in the English Schools Trophy. And, like, you know, one game, I remember after the game kind of getting handed a letter for England trials. So that was a really nice memory of the sort of stadium where you kind of get down to England trials. You're looking at the letter, you know, years later, because at the time you don't know anyone is. And then you look and you realise Richard Wright's there and a young lad called James Carragher from Sefton School. I think he had a reasonable career. And then the next round, we got knocked out by Leicester Schools, and Emil Eski got a trick against us.
Wow.
Got beat 4-0 or 4-1. But again, you kind of thought he might be destined for bigger and better things. From that, my dad's from near Sheffield and brought me and my brother up to be Wednesdayites. So we used to go through and watch Wednesday quite a lot. And then playing for Hull Schools, I got scouted and got asked to go down and play. I think it was for the under 15s. I was under 14s at the time. Went down and played Grimsby away. And after the game, they said, look, we like what we've seen. We want to sign your schoolboy forms, which obviously being a Wednesday fan was fantastic. Went on apprenticeship, signed a year professional. But opportunities were very limited at Hillsborough at the time. I mean, if I'd probably been good enough, they wouldn't have been limited. But it was you know, international players in the first team. You got your Chris Waddles and the like. And so after a year, I was going to be getting released. And the head of youth at the time, Clive Baker, came in and said, look, why don't you get in touch with Hull? You're from Hull. They'll know who you are. And just try and get down for a game. And I kind of like, yeah, Clive, whatever you say. And, you know, when you're 19, you're, 2 days later, he's asking, have you done it yet? No. So he comes storming into the shower after training, hands me this piece of paper. I think it was Bernard Ellison he'd spoken to, and he said, right, you're playing for the reserves next week. And I was like, oh, cheers, Clive. And then my coach at the time, Albert Phelan, just said, look, your mum and dad are still in Hull. Why don't you just get in touch with the club and ask to go down for a trial for a week or so? He said, because I think you're good enough to play for Hull City, and if the more you're down there, it can't do any harm. So I got in touch with the club and they were like, yeah, just turn up on Monday morning and we'll go from there.
Were you always a defender then?
I started off as a left winger. When I was young, big for my age. And kind of with that, I was relatively fast for that age. But as I got older, I kind of got to that point where I was quick enough to keep up with a quick winger, but not genuinely fast enough to blaze past the fullback. And so I kind of, and with the game adapting where fullback becoming more of a ball playing position, that's where I ended up.
And then, so that first reserve game then, who's taking that?
Well, it was under Terry Dolan was the manager and Jeff Lee was the assistant. And it was funny because I turned up for the game was on the Wednesday and I turned up on the Monday. And a few of the other lads have mentioned this, but on a Monday, they used to do a session at Sir Johnny Whiteley's gym. So I've just come from Sheffield Wednesday training ground, which wasn't exactly state of the art, to kind of a bite to Boothroy Park, like lock my bike up outside and made me way in. And then it was right then, lads, let's get going. Ran down to Eureka Gym and had a session in John's gym, which was, you know, What a great man. What a great person to meet on your first day at Hull City Football Club. An absolute legend who obviously sadly passed away recently. But from that, I was thinking, and this is like an honest thought at the time, I was going, some of these players are stinking of ale. Like, it's a Monday morning, small gym, sweaty kind of. And then we went back to Boothroy Park and ran up and down the steps on Kempton. So that was my first taste of third division training. I thought, I don't know if I'm cut out for this, but I was always relatively fit, so it didn't bother me at all. I just thought, where's the ball, you know? But then it got to the Wednesday, and the game was actually called off due to weather. So I stayed on for a further week's trial, and then I played the reserve game the following Wednesday. Did all right, and then Friday, I said, oh, well, look, Mansfield and Leighton Orient have also been in touch in terms of going down there. And Terry and Jeff said, oh, we don't think you need to be going there. We want to sign you.
It's obviously a good feeling then, like, you know, getting a release from Wednesday, signing for City.
Yeah, I was delighted because obviously you come away from the club that you supported as a boy, and that kind of dream's over. And then when a few clubs showed interest, Hull was obviously hometown club, a lot of friends who are City fans, even back in the day when there was only 3,000 there, you know, there's still like a core of my friends who went then and still go to this day. And just knowing Hull, it was my preferred choice. And when they said they wanted to sign me, I was obviously delighted getting another opportunity to try and make it in the game. My only regret is signing a 2-year deal rather than three. Purely because, as we might come on to later, with losing a full season through injury, and also what happened at the club in my sort of second year, if I'd have had another year to hang on in there, I might have had a better shot at it, but you know, hindsight's a wonderful thing.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously it was a tough season, but still had some big characters in that dressing room. Like, what do you remember from the characters at that time?
Well, what I think's, it's sort of interesting that coming from Wednesday, I didn't even know where the club were in the league. I didn't know any of the off-field sort of wranglings that were going on or anything like that. I just wanted to play football. So I've turned up, and while I was during the trial period, it was when Joycey celebrated in the Brighton game, did the celebration to the empty stand. And I'm like, what's all this about? what's going on? And people are start to explain, oh, you know, there's a lot going on. And then you start looking at the paper and getting a bit kind of, ah, right, okay, no, this isn't all plain sailing here. It's not just the football on the pitch that's the issue. There's all sorts going on. And the lads who kind of, you know, been involved in for a while, Steve Wilson and Adam Lothorpe, and seen that coming up. But it was certainly like a good set of lads, and it was a good camaraderie among the players, that's for sure. They made me very welcome straight away. But say just from there, I mean, I signed, and then I think it was midweek, I was playing reserves, and Gregor Riott was suspended, and Scott Maxfield did his knee, and I got to training the next day, and Warren Joyce sort of said, I hope you're ready to play. And I said, what you are? He says, well, think about it. We ain't got any other left backs. And so that, yeah, so I was like, oh, brilliant. Well, I've not, you know, just signed, and then relatively quickly, you're getting your debut.
Yeah, and is that Carlisle at home? Is that right?
Carlisle at home, yeah. I always joke with people because I played the Carlisle home game, and I got man of the match.
Really?
And then yeah, man of the match on my debut. And then I played Darlington away, and I did quite well also in that game. But then it was at the end of March, and so we had the bank holiday Monday game, and Gregor was back from suspension, and I got to the ground, and I was thinking, oh, you know, I'll be playing. And then Terry Dolan called me and said, oh, look, you know, it was one of those ones where when you're a young kid, you just accept it. But when someone says to you, you know, you've done really well, but we're going to put Gregor back in. And this is in no disrespect to Gregor at all, but you sort of feel like saying, well, that don't make any sense, because if I've done really well, you're going to keep me in the team. But I think, I don't know, obviously managers like stick with players that they know, which is fair enough. And then it was kind of from then on in, towards the end of that season, I was on the bench, got on the pitch a couple more occasions, against Leighton Orient and against Scarborough, I think it was. But that was it. So it was a little bit frustrating considering, I think from when I signed, I think we won one of nine remaining games. So, you know, you kind of, if you're not in a team that's winning, you can't have too many complaints. But when you're not getting on the pitch and they're struggling, you're kind of thinking, well, why don't they try something different?
Yeah, I was looking at that Leighton Orient game, 3-2. It must have been nice to be in a winning side, like to finish the season off kind of thing.
Yeah, it was. And I think, again, on the Tiger Cube thing, there's a video, and it's, I think the ball drops to me and I hit a shot, and he says something along the lines of, could this be Sharman's first goal for the Tigers? And you go in, it was not almost my last kick, let alone first goal. Could this be Sharman's last touch for the Tigers? But I mean, you can laugh at it now. I remember the chance, actually. I just tried to put it too much in the top corner. I think if I'd mishit it, it would have been a goal.
Yeah.
Yeah, never had a bad game for the Tigers. That's my claim to fame.
Yeah, I mean, getting man of the match in your first game, must be buzzing with that, even though obviously we lost the game. But
Yeah. I mean, you like a win, and I think Matt Janssen got the winner.
Oh, right.
And Rory Delac was playing for them. And it was a great occasion. It was just nice to, you know, come out on the pitch, and then, you know, the crowd were really sort of supportive. And, you know, my friends who were there were sort of saying that, you know, they were hearing positive comments from people. And that's, you know, if you've got supporters on your side, it's half your battle.
You know, we talked about Adam Lothorpe and I think Richard Peacock saying, like, you know, where you're gagging for a change that summer, and they kind of said, yeah, we were really. What do you remember of it?
I remember during the summer, I used to go and watch Hull FC or Hull Sharks as they were briefly. Yeah. Used to go and watch the rugby, and Tim Wilby was in one of the bars at the gate, and a friend of mine, Dean Simpson, his dad Wally Simpson, was heavily involved in sort of rugby league and stuff, and I was out with them, and Wally was talking to Tim Wilby and mentioned that was at City, and he kind of looked at me and he said, "What's your thoughts on Dolan and Lee?" And I'd only just got to the club, and I kind of was quite diplomatic, but as someone who was more of a, coming from a footballing background at Sheffield Wednesday, knowing that, you know, Terry and Jeff had got a bit more of a direct approach, and I thought a change might do me good, particularly not featuring towards the end of the season. So I kind of said, "Oh, well, you know, a change might be good." And he came back with, "Good, because I've sacked them both today." And I didn't know whether he was like winding me up, what he was, you know. And then, of course, you turn up for pre-season and Jeff and Terry are there to take the session. So everyone kind of said the goodbyes and what have you. But, you know, careful what you wish for with what followed, really.
Yeah. Was like a week Dolan and Lee had to stay, even though they knew they were getting binned off or something?
Yeah. I don't know how that came about. Again, when you're just a young player, you don't ask questions or think about the... Someone who's a coach now, you'd be kind of like looking at all the... and analysing what's going on here and why are they doing this. And, but I think it might have just been a gap where they needed to start pre-season. New management wasn't going to be in place. And yeah, Jeff and Terry, you know, fair play to them, took it on to take the lads for that start of that season.
And I always like to ask people what they made of Jeff Lee, really, because you hear mixed things, like took it too far sometimes kind of thing.
Being completely honest, I didn't get to see any of a few of the lads used to call him the fire starter. I didn't used to see him in full flow. But I heard enough stories, enough tales to think that that kind of approach, I think, you know, the game was starting to change, and I think a few personalities were changing within it. And I don't know if that was always the way to get the best out of your players, just living by fear and intimidation, probably. I'm sure the psychologists will back that up now.
Yeah, yeah. So first impressions of Mark Hately then, like, what did you make of him?
Well, because of coming from his background, I mean, obviously you look at his CV as a player, and it's, you know, outstanding, and you've got to respect anyone who's played at that level for that amount of time. And so I was thinking, surely he's going to come in with a more of a footballing ethos. And given my sort of background and the time I spent at Wednesday in the way that we played, I thought this is going to really benefit me. And then it was sort of in pre-season, I started to develop some sort of pain in my groin. And eventually I pulled out of training. And it was frustrating because knowing what I know now, I can't subsequently did my physiotherapy degree, which led to my role at the university. Now, my injury was massively mismanaged, and it was just a sportsman's hernia that had had surgery. I could have been back on the pitch within a month, but I didn't kick a ball again until the end of March. So, in effect, I missed that entire season. But even when you're injured, you get to see the way that people, you know, are conducting themselves in terms of a coaching role. And I think, I don't know why, what the thought process was behind Mark Hately getting that role. I know a few people have said he was probably promised money and didn't get it. But even if you've got no money, part of being a manager is being pragmatic. He's basically managing. He's coming up with a strategy. He's looking at the players you've got and working out what's going to suit this club best with the materials that I've got. And I think he failed miserably on all counts, really. And then some of the other stuff you forget about. And, you know, listening to Richard Peacock talking about losing his place because Mark Hately puts himself back in for the Newcastle game, was it?
Yeah.
And his Versace suit, kind of Versace step comment. You know, he's the kind of bloke who joined the Navy so the world could see him, you know. And it just didn't... Where the club was at the moment, at that time, was struggling financially, and with the players they had, it was a bad appointment.
I think, like, Adam Lothrop and Definitely Richard Peacock said Billy Kirkwood was a bit different. You could kind of see why he could be a good coach.
Yeah, I mean, Billy, outstanding career, you know, European football with Dundee United. And I think as any player would do, if you were given a role as a manager and had not done it before, then you'd look around for people you've worked with. And Mark Haley obviously had a relationship with Billy and so brought him in. And again, I think Billy was, and I think his CV would suggest that he's a good coach. But my kind of later dealings with both Haley and Kirkwood, following my injury when I came back the next season, I fell into the category of player. Again, other lads have mentioned it, where it was they want you to leave the club, so they try and make life miserable for you by, you know, oh right, you guys are back in this afternoon training, or right, you lot, you know, hang on, back at 2 o'clock at Boothry Park, we're going to do some fitness work and all the rest of it. But there was no way in a million years they were going to kind of break me down by doing that. If anything, I just got fitter and fitter. But within that, you kind of say, right, forget what your coaching qualifications are, forget what your sort of coaching principles are, just treating people with a bit of decency, you know, being man enough to say, look, we don't want you, but you've got a contract that's remaining for this long. Is one thing, but trying to kind of almost bully people into submission. I think the PFA now have got quite a lot of stuff in place to prevent that sort of stuff, and rightly so. But in another workplace, it would be tolerated. But back then in football, it was almost a part and parcel.
So you say you're back fit in the March of 97, 98. How far away from the first team did you feel at that point?
About a million miles, really, because I'd been completely out. We used to go and do our rehab, but because of how disjointed all the training was, and sometimes training at university, training at different venues, turning up at the ground, sometimes going to what was Cosmopolitan or Cannon's Health Club at the time, you might not see people, let alone, you know, even if you're injured, you're moving in a different circle to the people who are playing. But back then, the way the club was structured, it was you could have weeks and not really have much contact with the players or the management. But I still thought, you know, go back in. I've got a season left to sort of prove myself, and was feeling quite optimistic. But it became evident very early on, even towards the end of the previous season, despite being injured and not really kicking a ball. I remember for whatever reason, I bleached my hair blonde in the kind of Gazza-esque style, and Billy and the gaffer, Haley, got me in the office. He's like, oh, can we have a word? And they sort of said, right, what are you doing with your hair? If you know, if you want to play any part of this football club, you'll get rid of that. And again, as a young player, you kind of like go home and then it shave your hair off. Whereas, you know, as a bit older, you'd probably be like, well, how about concerning yourself with some sort of strategy for getting this club out of trouble rather than worrying about what Sam Sharman's doing with his barnet, you know? It was, you know, it's the same as the professionalism by wearing suits, you know, that it's a gimmick rather than an actual substantial kind of change that's really going to, you know, professionalism isn't what you wear. It's the kind of culture you create, and they really failed at that.
Didn't exactly have the best barnet himself, did he, Hurtley?
No comment.
Remember, I always remember my dad saying once he went down at half-time into, I think he went to the manager's office or even the boardroom, and Hurtley was in there getting a massage instead of giving a team talk. Did stuff like that happen quite often?
Yeah, it was, I don't know, I think moved in the world that he did, you know, the circles that he moved in, Rangers, you didn't train on a Friday, you know, when you've got the best players in the league, that's easy to do, and wearing all the best gear, all that, you know, just the top footballer kind of world, coming down to Hull City, where the club was at that time. I just don't think he read the room very well. I don't think he had the self-awareness to kind of knock it down a gear or two. You know, you've got a club that's struggling to pay its players, and there's a Porsche, brand new Porsche, parked outside the little end of terraced house on North Road that was used as the manager's office. Then the next day, it's a Mercedes. It doesn't leave a good taste. And jetting off to testimonials and getting on the pitch. And despite, you know, not everyone knows testimonial games are not as high intensity, but when you're supposedly injured, I mean, in this day and age with, you know, Instagram and Twitter and the social media, you'd be absolutely mincemeat. But then it'd be more people to go off and do it, and it'd just be hearsay and the odd rumour here and there. But I think he was just living his own life, and he knew that he wasn't... The consequences of getting sacked from Hull City probably have had zero repercussions on Mark Hateley's life since that day. He'll still be a very wealthy, successful ex-footballer. Whereas the impact they had on the club for that period was almost, you know, devastating.
Yeah, I saw he'd released an autobiography recently, and I was interested to see how much you talk about City in it. Maybe get a paragraph or something.
Yeah, he might have a paragraph on Mark Greaves. But yeah. No, it's funny with Greavesy, because one of my favourite stories I tell people just about, like, football in terms of how, you know, opportunities and chances that come and go, that Billy Kirkwood went around the changing room one day handing out letters to the lads whose contracts were up at the end of the season, basically saying, you're not going to get a new one. And he handed one over to Greavesy, who looked at him and was a bit confused. He said, I've got a year left. And Billy sort of, are you sure? And Greavesy's like, yeah, I'm pretty sure. I know when my contract runs out. Anyway, a year later, following the change of management and Joycey getting in, Greavesy's getting supporters player of the year. And it's just that thing of either they'd got it completely right and Greavesy deserved to go, or Greavesy became an unbelievable footballer in the space of a year, or they just pitched it wrong and didn't realise they had a player who could do a job for him, but because he was one of the local lads who wasn't their player, he was going to be out the door. And there was Greavesy also got it in the neck when the horrendous 1-0 defeat away at Doncaster. We were coming back from that game and a few of the lads had sat on the bus, and, you know, you're gutted that you've lost, but you don't sit with your head in your hands crying all night long. And someone said something amusing and Greavesy laughed. And with that, Billy was down the bus with Hateley. You find it funny, do you? You think we've just lost to Doncaster? And Greavesy wasn't laughing at the game or the consequences or anything like that. They were just ready to have a go at him. And then the final one was in training. Greavesy, doing his job, got pretty tight on Mark Hateley. And was, I don't think the gaffer liked it. And he turned around and literally just kicked Greavesy just out of sheer frustration. And it's the sort of thing, well, people who know Greavesy know he's one of the nicest lads you'll ever meet, but he's quite a hard lad. And I wish he'd have maybe taken a bit of retribution himself at the time. That would give me some but yeah, I doubt that'll be in his book, but you heard it here.
Yeah, that's mad. Yeah, in terms of David Lloyd, how much interaction did you have with him? Because Richard Peacock said... I think there was some meeting where you all got dragged to London where he bollocked you all, kind of thing.
Yeah, we went down to London for this meeting, and it coincided with, I think, England were playing Chile at Wembley. So it was a sort of, okay, and I was thinking more about the England game, and I think Marcelo Salas was playing, good playing, again, great to watch these sort of talents. And then we got to the meeting, and it was farcical. It was, honestly... You'd have thought it was like some sort of mockumentary. If it had been filmed now, it would have been Ricky Gervais would have been behind it, you know. just and as it, I think you said about the comment about, you know, Glenn Hoddies, why don't you sign them then? I think it was a wealthy man who didn't really understand football, getting frustrated. You know, if you're plowing money in, then you're entitled to, you know, you've got an interest in it. But not knowing how to get the best response or understand quite what was going on. I think just frustration just got the better of him. And he thought, if I can sit these lads down in front of me and give them a telling off, that might have some sort of impact. But I think results show it didn't.
Yeah, and then skipping back a bit, like going into that season, what became the Great Escape season, what was your position at that time? Were you still out on the fringes kind of thing?
I was just... hanging on, really, I say, you know, surplus to requirements. And then when I think was it October time that the change took over, where Hateley got the sack and Joycey got the job. And Joycey pulled me and he actually said, fair play to him, said, look, you're a good player. I remember when you first came at the club, you could see you got talent. But I can see that clearly what the way you've been treated had an impact on you. But there'll be none of that going on under my watch kind of thing. You know, so I got back in training with the team and was involved in a few squads. But again, if I'm completely honest, based on the way that I play and my style of play, and you look at the personnel that came in for that great escape and where the club was, when you're trying to avoid relegation from the third division, John Whitney is going to be your left back all day long over Sam Sharman. But again, as I said, it's a testament to Joycey that he got away from that kind of treating you like a second-class citizen in order to get rid of you. A bit more, yeah, get involved in training, get involved with the squads, down to the games, the Villa Cup game. Still doesn't help you not getting on the pitch, but really that's what you want to do. But at least it was a kind of a better ending to my Hull City time than had it have continued under the Hayley regime, where I'd have just seen out the last few months training with the juniors and running my bollocks off on an afternoon.
Yeah, and you mentioned that cup run, because I put on Twitter that you're coming on, and a few people mentioned the article in what paper was it with the car?
The Sun.
The Sun, yeah.
The Sun, yeah.
I mean, how much of that was accurate, and how much of it was poetic license, shall we say?
No, do you know, it was actually, it was pretty much they hit the nail on the head, because I'd got my car. A mate of mine had landed a job as a car salesman. Bought a little car as a runaround, and then he got given a company car. So he had this old Nissan Cherry that he was going to scrap. And I said, oh, well, I'll have it. I could stop my bike into training. So I bought it, and it was all rusty and everything. So I had an afternoon of trying to like do all the rust on it. And yeah, I did paint the wheels red. I had like the red line on the side of it. And so when the paper came, they were just lapping that up. There was myself and Mike Edwards had this little mini. And for those who've not seen the article, it was a contrast between Man United, who were top of the Prem at the time, and Hull City, who were just about bottom of Division 3, about which cars the players drive. And my £100 Nissan Cherry and Mike's little white Mini were heavily featured, let's just say that, compared to Digby's Ferrari or Sheringham's Ferrari and whatnot. But yeah. It was, it's funny that, you know, you spend 3 years at a football, 2.5 years at a football club, and the lasting memory is a picture of you in front of a £100 buyer.
Well, we'll just finish off your time at City then, really. Like, obviously a positive season on the pitch from what had gone on, but what was it like for you in terms of the finish of that season?
It was frustrating not to be playing. But for the people in and around, obviously, the city that I'm from and the city I was living in, and, you know, by this time you've got friends who were still involved. And for me, I was pretty much... My contract coincided with the bleakest part of Hull City's history. I'm not saying it was anything to do with my signing, but it was. It were pretty dark days, and obviously players who came subsequently, who've kind of done the podcast and what have you, saw when the good times started to come back. But it was great for people like Willow and Neil Mann, who were there before when things were sort of not quite as bad. Stuck it out through those really bleak days, and then came out the other side and sort of helped the club on its way to bigger and better things. And everyone's got fond memories of Belfry Park, and it was a special place, and it was like an old football stadium. But really, that move to the new stadium was the catalyst for, you know, where things eventually went. I think the things you can do around a match day, in type, you know, revenue creation, creating a more family environment. I think that played a big part under that sort of Adam Pearson's sort of ownership. That the biggest city never to have a Premier League club was the old tagline.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was a shame. And then obviously they buried those demons. And
did you have a conversation with Joycey at the end of that season, or did you know what was on the cards?
Yeah, I kind of knew what was on the cards. And then as it was coming towards the end of the season, Joycey pulled me. And he just said, you know, your attitude's been great. You've trained well, this, that, the other. All the things that you say to players when you release them. But he also mentioned that there was a couple of young lads coming through the couple of apprentices who, you know, left-sided players who you could put on I wasn't on great money, by the way. But it was more about trying to justify a contract for a player who's not picked a ball for 2 years, as opposed to a young lad coming through. And for whatever reasons, you know, maybe I just wasn't good enough, but I never really got a fair crack, which was a frustrating thing. But I went to Gainsborough Trinity from there just before the season ended. I went up and had a couple of games for them, and then it was a case of just, you know, you may as well leave now and then go and finish off the season with Gainsborough with a view to starting there next season, where Paul Olsen, another ex-Hull player, was the assistant coach. Yeah, but it's interesting because, you know, you talk about the stadium and Adam Lofthorpe and the lads talking about the players that you had those shared experiences with. And I think even people who you didn't necessarily share it at the same time, whenever I used to turn up for the ex-Tigers, you were straight into the banter about things relating to the club and about the ground. And, you know, like Pete Skipper, the first time I met him, you kind of just straight into it like you've known each other all your lives, because it's just football people having a chat. And, you know, that group of players and played under Neil Buckley at Barton Town. And again, like every now and again, we'd have a little comment relating to something that went off at the, or running around the back pitch or running around the track or something like that. And so fond memories overall.
Yeah, I remember my dad and your dad had a good relationship during your time at City as well, I think. Was he always around the club? Yeah.
Yeah, my mum worked at Hull University, and she was kind of involved in the business school who were behind all the when they eventually got the sponsorship. Prior to that, the university had done a great job of, when Simon Corkill was there as a commercial manager, kind of getting involved with all the, you know, the match day meals and all the sponsorship, which for anyone who went in those days, you're in a room with a sloping ceiling because it's at the back of the stand, and making do with what they got. You know, the stadium was never built with the sort of commercial side in mind, and they did the best with what they had. And any companies that, you know, got on board and were willing to support the club, it was greatly appreciated. And I think through that, you know, your dad was always around, and my dad chats more than me, which is nearly impossible. But it used to kind of, you know, you build relationships with people, and football's great for that. And again, shared experiences, you're all kind of wanting the best for the club, you're all in the same place, you all know what's going on, and you're just trying to get the best for the team on the pitch and the best for the club financially off it.
Yeah, we'll go on to those Twitter questions then, Sam. Mention Brian Johnson, and he says, ask Sam if he still pays kids' prices for his boots.
Yeah, I've got small feet. I got size 7, but I used to wear 6 in football boot.
Okay.
And so whenever I rocked up for training, Brian would be like, what size are they? You're like going to fall over any smaller. Yeah.
And then got one from LVI Ram Shami on Twitter, who said, it's a bit of a monologue. He says, Sam Sharman ended up in Spiders with Neil Whitworth one Saturday night during the 98-99 season. But my question is, how drunk was Neil? Because he rarely played for City again after that night. Also, has Sam got his head around what a pink Pugsley is?
You know, well, when you're a whole lad and you get these new players come and sign, you've got to give a bit of the local info, and everyone might be going to your LAs and what have you. But, you know, you've not had a whole night out back then until you've been to Spiders and the drink concoctions that they used to throw together. But yeah, so that'd be a night in Spiders. Memories.
I think it's the one place I'd go now if I was going out in Hull, just for the nostalgia, I think. Yeah, it's funny to think about City players walking around there. That's funny.
It doesn't exactly kind of tick the footballer box, does it? But I think when you look back now and Adam talking about getting off the bus and going straight in LA's, and it was that period where it was just as it was starting to move into the much more professional, much more, you know, sports science. But there was still an element of, if you were a good footballer and you liked a beer, then you was going to get a game and you could still have a beer. And you look at the likes of the young players coming through now, and, you know, Jacob Greaves and Keane Lewis Potter, and I've had a bit of contact with those lads when I did some physioing for Hull Academy. And you look at the infrastructure and the sort of training strategies that are in place for them, and they're cut from a different cloth, really. But the rewards of the game are so much greater that, you know, you become probably a little bit robotic in terms of the way you treat and the way you treat your body. But if you're going to be a robot who's going to get paid a lot of money for using the goods, then it's a sacrifice worth taking. I mean, it loses a little bit of the romance of it when you hear about these guys falling out clubs at whatever time and then still banging a hat trick while half cut.
Who is the best player? Who is the player that could do that for City? Who could perform the best after a big night out?
You know, the lads, to be fair to the lads, although they like going out after the game, there was everyone understood what was required beforehand and you know, trained hard. As a lad and as a player, I've spoke about him already. Like, I thought Greavesy, just as honest as the day is long, and you knew what you were getting with Greavesy, fit, strong, would, you know, body on the line. Neil Mann, again, I think Manny transitioned during that period of the club because he was one of the kind of, I think the came from sort of non-league with that culture of, you know, the beer and everything. And then as the club started to move more professional, he very quickly adapted and got probably the fittest he ever got was later in his career after his injuries. And it put him in good stead and his attitude changed, which is why he went into coaching, I think. And now obviously out in Australia doing a good job out there.
One question I missed was from Boofy Pat Memories, and he said, ask Sam what he really thought about Radders and his physio treatments.
I wasn't there long enough to, because what happened, it was, things got a little awkward politically in terms of who was delivering the physio at that time. Although one of my favourite memories of Radders is, myself, Bob Dewhurst, Adam Lothorpe and Ben Morley were all injured. And you've done your rehab, you've done your training, you're just trying to kill time. So we got in Radder's office and we made it like a kind of wacky warehouse thing where sellotaping down the phone receiver so he couldn't answer it, and then elastic banding his coffee mug to the desk so he couldn't pick it up, and turning pictures upside down, and you just, you know, putting buckets of water on top of the door like the Chuckle Brothers, you know. Yeah, and then calling Ben Morley, and it was an apprentice, to come through to test them out. Like, Ben, you want to come through? And he walks through the door and a bucket of water drops in his head. You look back now and you think, we was getting paid for that. But I say, we had done our training before, but poor old Radders, yeah, he was, for weeks after, I think he was finding all sorts of, you know, bits of his office and chair legs loosened and all that. But yeah.
Ah, spot on. You'll never catch that tiger. Thanks for listening to this episode of This Was Boothroyd Park. As always, just like to give a quick shout out to those who made the research easy, including OnCloud7, TigerTube Player, Tiger Bass, and Rich Gardens The Decade.